Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Kelly Pyle, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. Today's show features articles from the April 8th issue of People Magazine, as well as the April 2024 issue of Real Simple. I'll be sharing a variety of articles, including Kate's Cancer Rocks the Monarchy, Cut the Clutter, How Smartphones Are Hurting Our Kids, and Exporting Joy. Kate's Cancer Rocks the Monarchy. Facing a storm of rumors, the royal mom of three reveals a devastating diagnosis just weeks after King Charles disclosed that he too has cancer. How the Royal Family is Coping with the Unprecedented Crisis, by Simon Perry from People Magazine. Sitting alone on a wooden bench in the garden of Windsor Castle, near her home with Prince William and their three children, Prince George, 10, Princess Charlotte, 8, and Prince Louis, 5. Princess Kate prepared to tackle the most difficult speech of her life. In a video that sent shockwaves around the globe on March 22nd, Kate revealed that she had been diagnosed with cancer and was undergoing chemotherapy. The royal mom, so famous for her unerring poise, spoke about initially keeping the diagnosis private for the sake of our young family, her voice cracking with emotion. Against a backdrop of yellow daffodils, often seen as a symbol of hope for those with cancer, Kate managed a hint of a smile as she concluded, "I am well." To others dealing with cancer, she counseled, "You are not alone." Says a source close to the royal household, she held it together. At 42, Kate is carrying an extraordinarily heavy weight on her slender shoulders. A scary diagnosis. She has not disclosed the type or stage of cancer, but said it was discovered after her January 16th abdominal surgery, along with the eyes of the world on both her health and what her illness might mean for the future of the monarchy. But sitting in that garden, the same place where Queen Elizabeth had spent extensive time during her final years, Kate was focused only on sharing her truth in her own words. She wrote the words herself and delivered it personally. She wanted to decide when the right time was right to tell the world, says her former private secretary, Jamie Lowther Pinkerton. It is an incredibly important thing that she's done. I thought, this is our future queen. Goodness, what courage. She showed remarkable composure given all that had been swirling around. Indeed, the cancer announcement followed weeks of intense social media speculation about Kate's health and whereabouts, which reached a fever pitch with the release of a photo shared by the palace for UK Mother's Day on March 10th, in which Kate was shown looking vibrant alongside her three children. When major news agencies pulled the photo after determining it had been manipulated, Kate admitted to editing the image and apologized. The rare misstep only served to fuel the rumor mill. Then came a distressing report on March 19th that staff at the London clinic allegedly attempted to access Kate's medical records. It quickly became clear that she and William, 41, were at the center of a storm unlike any other they'd faced before. It unleashed a pent-up feeling that people wanted information. Unfortunately, that's the curse of being a modern royal, says a former longtime palace aide. In stark contrast to King Charles' swift and clear cancer announcement on February 5th. Kate's health news came after weeks of uncertainty and confusion. Royal historian Amanda Foreman says of the chaos, "This was the day that the royal family came crashing down to earth, and you realize they are just human beings." Kate's vulnerable video address, of course, is a reminder that cancer knows no hierarchy. And in King Charles, 75, Kate has someone with whom she can share her journey. This marks the first time in the monarchy's history that two senior royals are facing cancer simultaneously. The king was said by the palace to be so proud of Catherine for her courage in speaking as she did. The day before Kate's video was released to the world, he and Kate shared a private lunch at Windsor Castle. He has always had a very good bond with her. I don't think it is presumptuous to say she is like the daughter he never had, says royal biographer Sally Bettles-Smith. He shares with William an impulse to protect her. They are in this together, Kate and the king. Apart from being king and future queen, they are also two patients going through a common health experience, says a royal source, noting they are bound to have a close connection. I imagine there was some comfort for Kate in seeing that it was possible to balance some private information without there being an imperative to share all. The public now knows that in addition to recovering from major abdominal surgery, the nature of which has not been disclosed, Kate began a course of chemotherapy just a few weeks later, in late February. This timing also aligns with William's headline-making absence from the February 27th memorial service for his godfather, King Constantine of Greece, which royal sources now confirm was due to Kate's cancer, but at the time went unexplained. Always wary of leaks to the press, Kate has been open about her diagnosis to some, but other close friends and confidants were unaware. "It was a hell of a shock," says one. Adds the former palace aide, "the circle of knowledge was very tight." Behind the scenes, Kate has been taking steps to prioritize her health and well-being, but she hasn't been in complete seclusion. Both she and William have been spotted at their children's sports events and lessons in recent weeks. On March 16th, the couple were photographed running errands together at Windsor's farm shop. "Having fun together when they can is very important," says a family friend. "This is about her feeling supported. She doesn't feel isolated at all." Kate's parents, Carol and Michael Middleton, have been an additional source of help, with Carol accompanying Kate on school drop-offs. Kate's younger siblings, Pippa, 40, and James, 36, along with their families, are also nearby. In a touching statement, accompanied by a photo of himself and Kate as children, James wrote on Instagram, "Over the years, we have climbed many mountains together. As a family, we will climb this one with you too." While Kate's health crisis has strengthened the safety net around her, it has also highlighted the royal family's ongoing estrangement from Prince Harry, 39, and Meghan Markle, 42, who learned the news at the same time as the rest of the world. However, they privately reached out to William and Kate following the announcement and publicly released a statement. "We wish health and healing for Kate and the family and hope they are able to do so privately and in peace." Harry is expected to be in the UK in May for a series of events related to the Invictus Games. "Times like this bring people closer together," says the former palace aide. "Hopefully, this will produce a more positive outcome." Amid the challenges of his wife and father's both battling cancer, tensions with his brother are the least of William's concern. There will be a lot more pressure on William, but he's always been aware of that. He has evolved to lead, and he is leading, says the former palace aide. He is well equipped for it, and he has his priorities in order. In this time of crisis, they've been shutting themselves away and focusing on family and the children. That is what the Queen did when Diana died, despite the criticism. Adds a close palace source, William is incredibly stoic and strong. He took a lot from the way his grandmother operated, and his playbook is modeled on hers. It's going to be incredibly difficult, but he is a man who is used to shouldering pressure. In the days following Kate's announcement, she and William resumed focusing on their children, who are currently on their Easter break. The family of five will deviate from tradition by opting out of the royals' Easter services at St. George's Chapel. Instead, they will spend the long weekend privately at home. William will resume public duties after the children return to Lanbrook School on April 17th. Kate, who will remain out of the public eye during her treatment, may join in events when she feels able. But palace sources said that would not necessarily signal a return to royal duties. That decision will rest on doctor's advice. For now, her focus is on her full recovery with her family there to support her. She has the inner strength, the support of her husband and her extraordinary family, so she can focus on what's important, says Alyssa Anderson, a former spokeswoman for Queen Elizabeth, which is her getting back to strength. Those closest to her say they have every hope that when she is ready, Kate will return stronger than ever. The royal family is vulnerable at the moment, and there will be an even greater appreciation that they are human beings with frailties like the rest of us, says the former palace aide. They are so dedicated to their roles. I think you will find when Kate makes a full recovery, she will come back even more passionate. Kate breaks her silence. In an unprecedented moment, the Princess of Wales gave a rare address to the world in which she revealed her cancer diagnosis. I wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you, personally, for all the wonderful messages of support and for your understanding whilst I have been recovering from surgery. It has been an incredibly tough couple of months for our entire family, but I've had a fantastic medical team who have taken great care of me, for which I am so grateful. In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London, and at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found that cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I am now in the early stages of that treatment. This, of course, came as a huge shock, and William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family. As you can imagine, this has taken time. It has taken me time to recover from major surgery in order to start treatment. But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte, and Louis in a way that is appropriate for them, and to reassure them that I'm going to be okay. As I have said to them, I am well and getting stronger every day by focusing on the things that will help me heal in my mind, body, and spirits. Having William by my side is a great source of comfort and reassurance too. as is the love, support, and kindness that has been shown by so many of you. It means so much to us both. We hope that you will understand that, as a family, we now need some time, space, and privacy while I complete my treatment. My work has always brought me a deep sense of joy, and I look forward to being back when I am able, but for now, I must focus on making a full recovery. At this time, I am also thinking of all those whose lives have been affected by cancer. For everyone facing this disease in whatever form, please do not lose faith or hope. You are not alone. You've been listening to Kate's Cancer Rocks the Monarchy from People. Cut the clutter. Clear out what's taking up space in your home and your mind. By Erica Finnamore, illustrations by Rose Wong. This is from Real Simple Magazine. Clutter tends to sneak up on you. One minute, you have a coat closet full, but not too full of coats. The next, it's bursting at the hinges with sports equipment, pet supplies, broken appliances, and yeah, way too many puffers. How does it happen? Pretty easily. First, blame the gazillions of items available for two-day shipping. Need a bathrobe for your dog? A pack of artificial lemons? 6 dozen pink taper candles? They're all just a few clicks away. Then there's the human instinct to feel attached to your things, which makes it harder to part with them, especially if you're the nostalgic type, says Carolyn Caldwell, a certified professional organizer based in Toronto who specializes in chronic disorganization. People who are sentimental tend to assign equal importance to many, many things, and that makes it difficult for them to prioritize. Even if you're not emotionally invested in that ice cream machine, maybe you keep it around on the off chance you'll need it someday, or because you like the idea of being someone who makes their own ice cream. Finally, it takes more effort to combat clutter than to accumulate it. If you do nothing, things just pile up. If you're a woman and you're feeling seen, know this. Women are more likely than men to be told their excess stuff is clutter, says Joseph Ferrari, PhD, a deacon and a professor of psychology at DePaul University. In our culture, women are instructed to declutter. Men are told that must be your hobby or those are your toys. In short, we're trained to be a bit hard on ourselves. Whether it's clutter or not, if we think of it as such, there can be real side effects, Ferrari adds. What we've found is that the more clutter there is, the less sense of home you have, the less satisfaction, and the more indecision. We're not just talking about an icky feeling, but a concrete effect on your life, he says. When the living space is impacted, it causes people stress and impairs their functioning. Ask yourself the following questions, Ferrari says. Does my clutter make my space less comfortable to live in? Does it cause me emotional distress? Does it affect my relationships with other people? Answering yes to any of these doesn't mean you're a hoarder. That is very different and a serious mental health condition. But it does mean you could probably get rid of some things. Maybe you have an unruly spice rack, a closet you're scared to open, or too many piles. Whatever your issue, keep reading. We spoke with organizing and decluttering pros and gathered the best tips to get you started, keep you focused, and help you conquer Stuff Mountain for good. State your goal. It's tough to motivate yourself if you can't pinpoint why you're doing something, says Amy Tokas, a certified professional organizer based in Kansas City, Missouri. So identify the reason you're clearing out space. You need a spot to practice yoga, for example. If you're struggling to decide whether to get rid of an item, ask, "Is it more important than my goal?" Tokas says. Set a deadline for achieving your aim. That should keep you on task. Don't buy organizers. Not at first, anyway. You won't really know what you need until you dwindle down what you have, Tokas says. Toss or donate your unwanted items, and then see if you can repurpose some of your baskets and bins to corral your smaller stash. If your current collection of organizers isn't working for you, then you can consider doing some shopping. Tip: measure the shelves and drawers in question and bring those numbers with you. Pick low-hanging fruit. Different items come with different amounts of emotional baggage. Start with what's easy, like your abundance of muffin tins, and work your way toward the heavier stuff, your late dad's old ties, as you get into the swing of things. Give items an expiration date. Scared to part with something in case you'll need it later? Put it aside in a cardboard box labeled with a future date. 2 weeks from now, 3 months, a year, whenever. If you haven't used the item by that time, it's gotta go, says Anita Yakota, a therapist turned interior designer. If you decide to save it, there has to be a purpose for it. Take baby steps. Set a timer for 15 minutes. Spend just 900 seconds each day clearing stuff out. It will give you confidence in your ability to shed and strengthen your decision-making muscles, Caldwell says. The more often you make the call to toss or donate something, the easier it will get, promise. Pick out 5 things. Every day, look around your house and move 5 items to the donate pile or the trash. At the end of the month, that'll be 150 things. If you don't have a ton to declutter, make it 1 item per day. You'll still get rid of 30-ish items a month. Focus on a single spot. Target one tiny area you can finish in one little chunk of time. Tokas suggests something like a kitchen drawer. You might be inspired by the momentum and move on to tackle a second or even third small area. Invite your friends to hang out. Having a company over to support you while you complete a task can be super motivating. Whether it's the accountability factor or the energy of another person, it can help, Caldwell says. While they're there, ask them to hold the stuff for you, rather than touching it yourself. Ferrari says making physical contact with an item can intensify your emotional connection to it. Your BFF can lift up one thing at a time, and you can make a more objective ruling about keeping it or donating it. It might just be easier than expected to choose the latter. Remember 2 phrases. Number 1, if everything's a treasure, nothing's a treasure. It is hard to let go of sentimental items, like your kid's first report card, their baby shoes, their 14 soccer trophies. But if you keep all the things that have ever meant something to you, then which ones are truly special? When you downsize, you're saying, here are the real treasures that represent who I am and what I want to share with people, Tokas explains. Number 2, what's the cost of keeping it? Many of us fear we'll toss something only to have to buy it again later, when we realize we actually need it. That said, holding on to things comes at a price too. How much do you spend on maintenance? Does the item take up valuable space in your home? Tokos reminds us that there's also an emotional weight. We can feel heavier when we have stuff we don't need. Identify trigger items. Lots of emotions are tied up in our things. Love, pride, grief, anger, etc. If, while you're decluttering, you come across something that makes you extra emotional, put it in a box, label it, and move on to something else. You don't have to deal with it right now. Come back to it in an hour, a month, or when you feel ready. Give yourself permission to break up a set. Just because you inherited 3 cabinets worth of your grandma's dishes doesn't mean you have to keep them all. Select key pieces and let the rest go, Caldwell says. It's not an all or nothing situation. Make it more fun. To quote a famous nanny with a magical handbag, a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down. Chores are more fun when they're paired with something less taxing. Listen to your favorite playlist or pick up your go-to coffee shop drink to sip on while you sort. Match up decluttering with something you love, and then you can associate it with good times and good things, Caldwell says. Hold on to memories, not stuff. You can keep moments alive without stockpiling bulky mementos. Take a photo of an item, or better yet, a pic of yourself with the item, and save that, upload to your computer or the cloud. Instead, keep the memory, keep the sentiment, but don't necessarily keep the object, Caldwell says. This has been Cut the Clutter from Real Simple Magazine. You are listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer broadcaster, Kelly Pyle, and this is the Women's Hour. Jennifer Garner, oh, she glows. Yes, she loves her moisturizer, but a good workout and great friendships also make the actress radiant. By Jackie Fields, this is a People Magazine exclusive. Fun fact, if you visit Jennifer Garner's house, you'll leave with a product or two. I really stock like a showroom. I cannot help but send people home with my favorite things, says the actress, 51, who's been a Neutrogena brand ambassador for 16 years. But even with her shelves of lotions and potions, Garner's approach to beauty remains less is more, and also being comfortable in her own skin. We should know how to feel and look as great as we can without any makeup, she says. Here, she shares what makes her feel good on the inside and out. What's the latest chapter in your partnership with Neutrogena? I was just at the American Academy of Dermatology annual meeting with them to help educate people about what is actually going to get the job done for your skin. I think these young kids that are following trends on TikTok, they're having fun and that's awesome, but there's a difference between what's viral and what's vital. Speaking of young kids, you've been in the spotlight for nearly 30 years. Does the fact that you have grown up in the public eye ever cross your mind? It does. I was in D.C. recently advocating for WIC and SNAP, nutrition assistance programs. And up on the wall in a senator's office was a time where I had met with him like 15 years ago. And he said, look how young you were. Does that bother you? You're getting older. And I thought, man, it really doesn't. I mean, maybe I have my moments, but honestly, mostly I am grateful just to be alive. And I'm grateful for the wisdom that I've gleaned out of these years, and really grateful to be able to watch other women go through this process of life so gracefully and to try to follow in their footsteps and tell other young women, take care of yourself, but don't be scared. Aging is a gift. What are some practices you have in the beauty and wellness space that are more than skin deep? I work out every day. It's super important for my mental health. I eat really well. I just finished a big old bowl of kale. And I have a really strong family and strong relationships in my life. I let myself have down days too. I don't try to be Pollyanna all the time. And I'm gentle with myself. What are you deriving the most joy from now? From my kids. Garner shares Violet, 18, Serafina, 15, and Samuel, 12, with ex-husband Ben Affleck. They're really solid right now. I'm just watching them in this new phase of life where they're figuring out who they're going to be and what they're going to study. Is it hard to let them steer? It's so hard. I have a really hard time not saying, this is what I see you as, and I think you should. I really have to sit on my hands. What are you doing for your birthday on April 17th? Every year, I do something that I love to include people in that feeds me. Last year, I went to a park in LA and planted trees with my kids. One year, we loaded backpacks up to give kids food to take home with them after school. I know what I'm going to do this year, and it's coming together. To me, that day is about, how am I going to look outside of myself? How am I giving back to the world that gives me so much? Jen's Beauty Loot. Garner is devoted to Neutrogena Hydro Boost Water Cream, $24 at Target.com, which has hyaluronic acid that binds moisture to the skin to make you dewy and plump, she says, and to Virtue products, she's a brand partner, including this recovery shampoo, $42 at virtuelabs.com. This has been a People exclusive. Jennifer Garner, oh, she glows. Minor issues, major opinions. Does recycling at home actually make a difference? Everyone's got thoughts. We collected yours, then we called on the experts to settle the debate once and for all. By Naomi Barr from Real Simple Magazine. Readers say, yes, every little bit helps. Individually, maybe not. Collectively, I'm sure it does. At the very least, we are making a huge problem a bit smaller. At LMDEA60. It makes me feel less futile in the face of climate change if I can at least recycle. At Robin Steffler. I'd rather keep recycling and believing I'm doing my small part to make things better. At Cindy Kronk. Nope, it doesn't matter. I'm becoming convinced that most of what we recycle does not actually get recycled. At Wendy Mueller. When you factor in the water we use to wash our recycling and the separate trucks, any resource savings is probably canceled out. At Our Luna Eclipse. From years of reading the news, I do not believe that most plastics are recycled. By Peek and Paw. And now the experts say, yes, you may have read articles questioning the effectiveness of recycling. And it's true, the proliferation of plastic is creating challenges. Still, experts say recycling works, And if you care about the planet, it's a must. According to the nonprofit, the Recycling Partnership, if all recyclable items in the U.S. were diverted from landfills, it would cut more than 107 million metric tons of carbon emissions a year, equal to taking almost 23 million cars off the road. Things can go awry when people don't follow their municipality's rules, says Nilda Mesa, director of the Urban Sustainability and Equity Planning Program at Columbia University. Nina Shaw, director of the Resource Conservation and Sustainability Division at the EPA, agrees. Recycling centers can only do so much, and putting non-recyclable or food-laden items in a bin can mean the whole batch ends up in a landfill. So follow guidelines for each material. In some towns, glass has to be dropped off at a collection point. Keep grease-coated pizza boxes out of the cardboard pile, but a few specks is fine. Rinse out your plastics and check the number. Plastic containers are stamped 1 through 7. While 1 and 2 are usually recyclable, the rest depends on your area, Shaw says. When we get it right, we make a difference. Recycled aluminum comprises 80% of aluminum production in the U.S. And according to the most recent EPA data from 2018, we recycle 68% of paper and cardboard and 31% of glass containers. The plastic stats aren't as great. Your best bet there is to consume less, especially, say it with us now, single-use plastic. So please reduce, reuse, and recycle as much as possible. With illustrations by Joel Holland, this has been Does Recycling at Home Actually Make a Difference? From Real Simple Magazine. Smart Money, the financial decision that changed everything. Sometimes one thoughtful shakeup can make a difference, as told to Lindsay Stanberry from Real Simple Magazine. I spent money on myself to land a better job and the big raise I deserved. L'Oreal Thompson Payton, 36, Evanston, Illinois. I was working in external affairs for a nonprofit, and I learned from some peers in similar roles in the same sector that I was underpaid by nearly $30,000. I tried to negotiate a raise, but I was told, in so many words, "Sorry, we're a nonprofit. There's nothing we can do." Determined to find a job that would pay me what I'm worth, I decided to hire a career coach, which, at $100 an hour, was a hefty investment for me on my salary. She helped me update my resume, make a 5-year plan, and come up with a list of non-negotiables for my next job. One day, while scrolling LinkedIn, I found a listing for a director of communications role at a nonprofit that felt like it was created for me. The job description even stated that the ideal candidate should scroll X, which was Twitter at the time, every morning with coffee, something I still do to this day. Plus, when I visited the company's website, I was thrilled to see that the staff was diverse, one of my non-negotiables. After a few rounds of great interviews, I got the job and increased my salary by $30,000. Receiving the offer and then quitting my job came with a surprising range of emotions. I was pissed that I had been underpaid for so long. That's never a good feeling. But I was proud that I advocated for myself and didn't settle for just any job. I diversified my investments to make progress toward my financial goals. Sienna Simmons Afari, 33, Peachtree City, Georgia. While my husband and I had been diligently saving for retirement, we also had big goals we wanted to achieve sooner. We knew investing could help us get there faster, so we started working with a financial firm recommended by my brother-in-law, who is also a client. We gave the firm some money in the low five figures to invest and put a chunk into a high-yield savings account. Next, we invested in real estate, putting a down payment on a house as well as two other properties. The firm emphasizes goal-based investing, which means we tell our advisor what we want to do with our money, both today and in the future. Then they put together a personalized plan to achieve those goals through smart, diversified investments. We meet with our advisor annually to review our portfolio, a mix of low-cost exchange-traded funds and bonds, make sure we're on track to hit our goals, and decide if we want to add or adjust anything. Since we started investing in 2020, we've seen around a 30% return. We know there are ups and downs in the market, and we're playing the short game. On our list of short-term goals, we have some home improvement projects and continuing education classes we want to pay for. Long-term, my husband and I want to buy several acres of land and open a bed and breakfast. Last year, we crossed a major medium-term goal off our list. We bought a new-to-us SUV shortly before our second child was born. Because of our careful planning, we didn't have to cash out any of our investments. We use money from our high-yield savings account. It has 4.35% APY right now, to make a down payment and took out a small car loan, which had a lower interest rate than what we make on our investments annually. Though I was somewhat nervous about the process, I felt really secure knowing we had the funds and our purchase wasn't stopping us from achieving our other goals. I moved to a cheaper city to get out of debt and rethink my spending and saving. Cheria Young, 40, San Francisco. I'm a California girl through and through. But living in San Francisco with a mound of student loan and credit card debt was keeping me in a financial rut. Then in 2017, I was in Memphis for a conference at my company's headquarters when one of the speakers started talking about the power of the Mississippi Delta. "You are sitting in this room because things grow here," he said. And while he wasn't specifically talking to me, I felt in my gut that I needed to move to Memphis to see how I could grow there. A few months later, my dream job opened up within the company, and I made the move to Tennessee. It seemed like fate pushed me to leave California so I could grow in the Delta. I knew I had to make other big changes in my life. Before I moved, I sat down and looked at my finances and saw a clear path forward to free myself from debt. It was a little intimidating and empowering at the same time. My fresh start was a good excuse to get my money in order. The new job did not include a substantial salary bump, but the cost of living is so much lower in Memphis that it allowed me to make big lifestyle changes. I moved into a less expensive apartment and downloaded an app called YNAB, which stands for You Need a Budget. It encourages users to think about every dollar they spend. Through the app, I started assigning each dollar a purpose. My dining out budget was called community building, because I knew that when I did eat out, I should make the time count. And I started carpooling with my work bestie. Being so mindful of money let me pay off my student loans and all my credit card debt, close to $20,000 total, in the 2 years I lived in Memphis. I did move back to San Francisco. I told you I'm a California girl, but this time without any debt and with a better relationship with money. Also, I was able to keep my job, and I got a raise to account for the cost of living in my new but old city. This has been the financial decision that changed everything, from Real Simple Magazine. People Health, Youth Mental Health Finding Solutions. How smartphones are hurting our kids. We've never seen anything like this, says author and psychologist Jonathan Haidt. There's a massive evidence of harm from people. When NYU social psychologist Jonathan Haidt looks at the charts tracking teen mental health, he sees an undeniable truth. Beginning in 2012, 5 years after the introduction of the iPhone, and 2 years after Instagram debuted, anxiety and depressive disorders go up with a sharp increase, he says. Since then, incidents of self-harm and suicide rates among teens have more than doubled. It happened in many countries at the same time, at a specific point in time, the moment when teens traded their flip phones for smartphones, Haidt says. It's as if you had a murder and all eyewitnesses point to this suspect. In his new book, The Anxious Generation, out now, Haidt examines the connection between this great rewiring of childhood and the decline in teen mental health, and advises how to help. What's the connection between smartphones and kids' mental health? Imagine there was suddenly a toy introduced which would cause children to get less sleep, less exercise, and spend less time with other children. It would make them incredibly self-conscious, and it would lower their self-esteem and cause depression and anxiety. That would be horrible, right? We've seen a loss of the play-based childhood, which kids have always had, in favor of a phone-based childhood. 5 years ago, it was possible to say the link between mental health and smartphones is just correlation, but that's not true anymore. All evidence points to it. Why is online communication inferior to real life? When you give your child a smartphone, you're giving them an experience blocker. The way you interact on social media is nothing like face-to-face. Emojis don't substitute for real smiles or laughter. And on social media, interactions are asynchronous. You say something, and you wait and worry. Why didn't she respond? When two friends talk in real life or by phone, there's no anxiety. They're connecting. Real connection is bonding, not performative. On a social platform, you perform to the world, and there's constant social comparison. What needs to change? If Congress said you have to be 21 to drink, but we're going to give immunity to the alcohol industry, it's the parents' job to keep the children out of bars. That's the same situation we're in with social media. It's absurd. Parents can't possibly do that. The most important thing that the government can do is raise the age for social media use to 16. Once kids are on, there is no way to make it safe. Social media is brutal for children. It's crucial to require social media companies to age verify. If companies were responsible for harms to underage users, they'd solve the problem quickly. What can be done now? Schools should be phone-free. That's a no-brainer. Imagine if we could give kids 7 hours a day to free them up from the need to keep up. And the internet is not going to have guardrails soon. So it is incumbent on parents to delay the day our kids have 24/7 access to the internet, at least through middle school. That's when the maximum damage is done. Middle schoolers don't need their own smartphone. Give them a flip phone. That's a tough call if your kids' friends all have smartphones. Collective action is essential, and early action is most effective. For anybody with children under 10, link up now with parents of your kids' friends. Believe me, they're worried about this too. Coordinate. Your kids aren't going to get phones, but they are going to get a lot of time playing with each other. So it's not like, let's take away phones. It's, let's give our kids a childhood together. Sounding the alarm. We've overprotected our children in the real world and underprotected them online, says Haight of The Message in his new book, The Anxious Generation, which chronicles the fallout from kids who've experienced unprecedented exposure to the virtual world. By the numbers, 46% share of teens online almost constantly, and it doubles the 2015 figure. 237, average number of phone notifications teens receive daily. 1 in 5. Undergrads with depression, twice the 2010 number. 134% increase in girls' suicide rate since 2010. Sources, Common Sense Media, The Anxious Generation. You've been listening to How Smartphones Are Hurting Our Kids from People Magazine. Good news, exporting joy. Want to get a little happier? Look no further than Finland. The Nordic country has repeatedly clinched the very top spot in the World Happiness Report, and its tourism board is spreading the joy with an online class in happiness, or Onnellisuus in Finnish. The program covers 4 areas key to Finns' positive mindsets: nature and lifestyle, health and balance, design and everyday, and food and well-being. Each lesson includes a short video or two, plus homework, like spend some phone-free time in nature, tell someone you're sorry, upcycle an item in your home, or cook a new recipe. Upon completion, you'll get a certificate you can hang as a reminder to nurture the things that keep you fulfilled. The best part? The course is free. You can't put a price on happiness after all. Learn more at visitfinland.com. By Melissa Matthews, from Real Simple Magazine. George Lopez, One Last Thing. The actor, 62, stars with his daughter, Mayan, on the CBS sitcom Lopez vs. Lopez. From People. Last time I danced. I danced in my garage, of all places. Whenever I let the car warm up, if I hear 10th Avenue Freeze Out by Bruce Springsteen, I just dance. Last vice. I sold flowers when I was 14 to buy a guitar, and it's become my vice to buy them. I have 60 in my house. It helps because everybody whose poster I had on my wall, I became friends with in life. Carlos Santana. I send Kisses Paul Stanley flowers on his birthday every year. last time I faced a fear. I jumped off a 40-foot cliff in Hawaii. My legs were a little too straight, so I bruised my tailbone. But now I've done it. I don't think my skeletal structure at this stage could do it again. Last DIY project. I'm not handy, but I'll tell you why. I was cleaning my rain gutters on my first house. The guy I bought it from asked if I was a professional gutter cleaner. I said, I'm not. He goes, what are you? I said, I'm an actor, a comedian. And he says, then get down before something happens and you never act or tell jokes again. I don't take a lot of advice, but I take it when it makes sense. Last thing I learned about myself. If I don't take a shower by 2 p.m., I'm going to stay in the same clothes all day. You know when they say, Elvis never left his upstairs? I get it now. With reporting by Julie Jordan, this is One Last Thing, George Lopez, from People. Thank you for joining us today for the Women's Hour. My name is Kelly Pyle, and I am your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. I hope you enjoyed the articles today in our program, and I hope you'll make plans to join us again next week. Until then, have a wonderful day, and be sure to stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.